KSDP 830 AM Sandpoint, K201DA King Cove, KFPS False Pass.
The Prime Minister's office has made clear that Hamas have reneged on this hostage release agreement in an effort to extort last-minute concessions.
The ceasefire deal to end the war in Gaza is still on, but both sides are back to quarreling over details.
For Thursday, January 16th, it's All Things Considered from NPR News.
I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Like several presidents who came before him, Joe Biden vowed to close the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay.
Like the others, he did not succeed.
I think at the end of the day, Guantanamo is going to be open in some fashion when the Biden administration leaves office, and that is a failure.
And to be or not to be a car thief, our critic reviews Grand Theft Hamlet.
Which, obviously, is a staging of Hamlet entirely inside the video game Grand Theft Auto.
People are violent in Shakespeare, in brutal.
It's yeah.
Like in Hamlet, everyone dies. It's perfect.
Now the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Jack Spear. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says he expects a ceasefire deal for Gaza to go into effect Sunday as planned, despite some last-minute glitches. NPR's Michelle Kelman reports Blinken gave a final news conference at the State Department where he was interrupted by protests.
Secretary Blinken says the outgoing Biden team will work until the last minute to make sure the ceasefire and hostage deal that they've been working on since last May gets started this week.
It's not exactly surprising that in a process and a negotiation that has been this challenging and this fraught, you may get a loose end. We're tying up that loose end as we speak.
Blinken was interrupted twice by protests.
Criminal! Why aren't you in the Hague?
One man, Sam Husseini, was carried out of the briefing room, accusing Blinken of supporting a genocide. Michelle Kellerman, NPR News, the State Department.
The Senate held a confirmation hearing for Scott Bessent today. As NPR's Maria Aspen reports, the Wall Street Investor is President-elect Trump's nominee for Treasury Secretary.
The Treasury Secretary is the president's top advisor on economic policy. And Bessent showed up ready to defend President-elect Trump's plan for the U.S. economy. Bessent was particularly enthusiastic about renewing the tax cuts that Trump first passed in 2017 and that are due to expire this year.
This is the single most important economic issue of the day. This is pass-fail.
Many economists have warned that these tax cuts, along with Trump's proposed tariffs, could restart inflation and make the federal deficit soar. But Bessent repeatedly downplayed these concerns. He said in response to one question about Trump's economic policies that, quote, nothing I can immediately think of would increase inflation. Maria Aspen, NPR News.
The commercial company SpaceX says a test of its new Starship rocket has ended in partial failure. NPR's Jeff Bromfield is more on the mission.
Starship is the largest rocket ever built, and it's central to billionaire Elon Musk's dreams of getting to Mars. It lifted off without a hitch.
We have the stuff.
It flew towards space. Moments later, its giant booster rocket flew back to the launch pad and was caught successfully by two giant mechanical arms, which the company has dubbed Mechzilla.
You heard it here. Mechzilla has caught the booster.
But shortly after the booster catch, Starship appeared to have engine trouble on the final leg of its trip to space. SpaceX then lost contact. The company says it will launch an investigation into what went wrong. Jeff Brumfield, NPR News.
Americans wound down the year in something of a buying mood. The Commerce Department says retail sales rose 0.4% last month. Government says retail sales for December were higher as consumers shopped for everything from furniture to clothing to restaurant meals. You're listening to NPR News. United Health is posting better-than-expected profit numbers for its latest quarter. The company says for the 3 months ending in December, it beat Wall Street estimates. It was the first financial report by United Health since the shooting of one of its top executives in a New York City sidewalk by a man who claimed it was over the high cost of health care. United Health says more than 87% of the premiums it collected in the fourth quarter went to cover medical costs. Brazil's highest court has denied former President Jair Bolsonaro's request to leave the country to attend Donald Trump's inauguration, arguing he remains a flight risk. Julia Canaro reports from Rio.
Brazil's former president, Jair Bolsonaro, had requested permission from the Supreme Court to travel to Trump's inauguration next week. Bolsonaro's passport was seized last February because of investigations into whether he tried to stage a coup after losing re-election in 2022. Supreme Court Justice Alexandre de Moraes denied his request for this trip, arguing there was risk he would try to flee the country and evade justice. Bolsonaro is a fan of Trump and a strong right-wing ally in South America. This week, he told the New York Times he was, quote, feeling like a kid again with Trump's invite. Bolsonaro says his team will appeal the decision. For NPR News, I'm Julia Carneiro in Rio.
Visionary filmmaker and TV producer David Lynch has died. Lynch's works included the cult film Eraserhead, along with Blue Velvet and the TV series Twin Peaks. Lynch went public last year with the fact he was suffering from emphysema after years of smoking. David Lynch was 78 years old. I'm Jack Spear, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations. Other contributors include Corporation for Public Broadcasting, a private corporation funded by the American people, and the John S. and James L. Knight Foundation, helping NPR advance journalistic excellence in the digital age.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Just a day after an Israel-Hamas ceasefire agreement was announced, the two sides returned to quarreling over the details. The deal is still on, but the dispute demonstrates how difficult it's likely to be to keep it on track. NPR's Greg Myrie is in Tel Aviv. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Ari.
What's the stumbling block here?
Yeah, Israel's cabinet needs to approve the deal and was expected to meet and do so today. But the Office of Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu said Hamas was reneging on part of the deal. Now, it didn't specify what part. Hamas said this wasn't true. It's still committed to the agreement. The net result was the Israeli cabinet didn't meet. A session is now planned for Friday. One far-right Israeli party is voting against it and threatening to resign. It calls the deal a surrender to Hamas, but the agreement is expected to comfortably pass.
And in the meantime, fighting is continuing in Gaza, right?
That's right. Some pretty heavy Israeli airstrikes yesterday and today. More than 80 Palestinians have been killed and more than 200 injured in the past 2 days, according to Palestinian health officials. Now, Israel acknowledged hitting around 50 targets in Gaza. It says one of them was a Hamas militant who took part in the October 7th, 2023 attack in southern Israel that launched this war. And Ari, we've certainly seen this in the past where quite intense shooting takes place when a ceasefire is just about to take effect.
So when is the earliest a ceasefire deal might go into effect?
Well, Sunday looks like it would be the first day, and we should stress this is a process that, even if it goes as planned, will play out over many weeks. It's not going to happen in a day. This first phase of the deal alone lasts 6 weeks. Hamas is obligated to release 33 of the 98 hostages in Gaza. Israel will free about 1,000 prisoners during this period, and aid is supposed to surge into Gaza. But the hostages won't all be freed until a second phase. Some Israeli troops will remain in Gaza for many weeks to come. And then, even if everything is still moving along, we'll get to the really hard stuff. Who's going to rule Gaza after the Israeli troops leave? Who's going to pay for the rebuilding of the territory? So far, no clear answers to these very tough questions.
You know, President-elect Trump called for a ceasefire deal before taking office, and it's now happening just days before his inauguration. Did his statements help drive this process?
Well, Trump certainly believes so, and he said so on social media. No one here is saying that explicitly, but there seems to be some certainly circumstantial evidence. He did send his envoy, Steve Witkoff, to take part with diplomats from the Biden administration in the final days of these negotiations in the Gulf country of Qatar. And, you know, in taking credit, Trump is also assuming responsibility. It will be his ceasefire deal to manage come Monday. And there may be some irony here, Ari. It's kind of a reversal from the presidential transition 4 years ago. Trump made a deal in 2020 with the Taliban for U.S. troops to leave Afghanistan. President Biden inherited that agreement, and when he withdrew the U.S. troops, it turned into a real fiasco. Trump will inherit the Gaza ceasefire agreement, and there will be challenging days ahead. Remember, 7 U.S. citizens are among the hostages held in Gaza. At least some of them are believed to be alive. So the U.S. has been involved in trying to resolve this conflict, and its role won't end just because there's a ceasefire deal.
That's NPR's Greg Myrie in Tel Aviv. Thank you.
Sure thing, Ari.
Now, a story about hopes versus reality. When President Obama was elected, he pledged to shut down the U.S. military prison at Guantanamo Bay, Cuba, which became a symbol of unlawful detention for holding hundreds of suspected foreign terrorists without charge or trial. Here's Obama in 2008.
I have said repeatedly that I intend to close Guantanamo, and I will follow through on that.
But 8 years later...
With respect to Guantanamo, it is true that I have not been able to close the darn thing.
Then came Donald Trump, who made this vow in 2016.
This morning I watched President Obama talking about Gitmo, right? Guantanamo Bay, which, by the way, we are keeping open, And we're going to load it up with some bad dudes, believe me. We're going to load it up.
But President Trump did not send any new prisoners there. Then, when Joe Biden won the presidency, he renewed a goal he had made as vice president in 2016.
Do you think that you'll succeed in getting Guantanamo Bay closed?
That is my hope and expectation.
Well, now that President Biden's time in office is almost over, how successful was he at fulfilling his Guantanamo objectives? Here's NPR's Sasha Pfeiffer.
Biden, like Obama before him, faced staunch opposition to closing Guantanamo from a core group of Republicans in Congress. Here's Texas Senator Ted Cruz addressing Obama in 2016.
Let me say this, Mr. President. Don't shut down Gitmo. Expand it, and let's have some new terrorists there.
Still, Biden was able to make some progress. Early on, he reopened a government office that had been closed by Trump that works to release Guantanamo prisoners. Biden also transferred several prisoners to other countries, and his administration took a major step toward resolving the 9/11 case, which has dragged on more than 2 decades without going to trial. The alleged mastermind of the attacks, Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, agreed to plead guilty and serve life in prison in exchange for no longer facing the death penalty. Karen Greenberg is director of the Center on National Security at Fordham Law School.
There was a sense of aggressive movement, and then it just sort of dissipated.
She's watched with dismay as the Biden administration has backtracked on some of its Guantanamo decisions. For example, 2 days after that plea deal was reached with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed last summer, Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin reversed it. Here's Greenberg again.
It's always been one step forward, several steps backwards. That's been the story of Guantanamo, and I don't think the Biden administration has changed that at all.
A federal appeals court is considering whether the plea deal can go forward, and that legal fight will now play out during the Trump administration. Considering Trump's support of Guantanamo, that leaves Greenberg wondering if it will stay open until some of the other remaining detainees die of illness or old age.
I now cannot see a path forward for closure, and this is the first time I've really felt it's not going to happen, ever.
In just the past month, Biden did release more than a dozen additional Guantanamo detainees. But why the flurry of prisoner releases right before Biden leaves office and not earlier? Georgetown law professor Steve Vladek thinks it's because Biden was trying to avoid controversy during his tight reelection race last year.
It reflects a view that they couldn't do this before the election without provoking political blowback, and that if they don't do it now, it's going to be at least 4 years and maybe 8 before there's anyone else in a position to do it.
Vladek suspects a lack of political courage is also why the Biden administration backtracked on its plea deals with Khalid Sheikh Mohammed and 2 of his alleged accomplices. But Vladek doesn't get why the Biden White House keeps fighting the deals, since Biden no longer has to worry about losing votes over unpopular moves.
Man, I mean, especially now that President Biden's a lame duck, I don't understand the politics of this at all.
Scott Rehm of the Center for Victims of Torture says by waiting till the closing days of his administration to release prisoners who'd been cleared for release years earlier, Biden let those people languish behind bars unnecessarily. Now Rehm will be watching to see how President Trump handles Guantanamo.
Do you see his administration trying to undo the police?
It's definitely a possibility.
Legally, could it be done?
I don't think legally it could be done. Does that mean an incoming Trump administration won't try? No.
And although Rehm gives Biden credit for reducing Guantanamo's population to less than half what it was when he entered office,
I think at the end of the day, Guantanamo is going to be open in some fashion when the Biden administration leaves office, and that is a failure.
Sasha Pfeiffer, NPR News.
In his last week in office, President Biden has signed a sweeping executive order on cybersecurity. The goal is to shore up critical infrastructure and make it easier to punish cybercriminals who try to attack that infrastructure. NPR cybersecurity correspondent Jenna McLaughlin has more.
Ann Neuberger is President Biden's outgoing Deputy National Security Advisor for Cyber and Emerging Technology. She says the White House is hoping to put the U.S. on the front foot against its digital enemies in Biden's final days in office. To do that, Biden is signing a broad cybersecurity executive order. It's one of the last published during his tenure in office. Neuberger says it's designed to incorporate lessons learned over 4 years of major disruptive attacks, from hospitals shut down by ransomware to China getting a foothold in critical infrastructure.
The goal is to make it costlier and harder for China, Russia, Iran, and ransomware criminals to hack, and to also signal that America means business when it comes to protecting our businesses and our citizens.
Neuberger says the executive order is broken up into two major components. The goals are to increase cybersecurity standards across the federal government and its contractors, and to make it easier for the U.S. to punish cybercriminals who target U.S. critical infrastructure. For one, vendors selling to the government will have to prove they're abiding by security best practices and strengthen how they store security keys for identity management. Federal agencies will be pushed to use the latest email encryption and cryptographic standards. And by 2027, the government will only buy commercial products that come vetted and verified with a recently released cyber trust label. Meanwhile, the executive order will make it easier for the U.S. government to sanction cyber criminals who attack critical infrastructure, even the ones they can't link to foreign governments.
If somebody's attacking and disrupting a hospital in this country, it doesn't matter to us. It shouldn't matter if they're working for a foreign government or they're working for financial gain in our ability to use sanctions.
The Biden team is waiting for President-elect Trump to name his cyber team to discuss the particulars of the executive order, says Neuberger. In the meantime, she says they're having broad discussions on national security. The hope, Neuberger says, is that cyber is a bipartisan issue and that the executive order will set Trump's team up for success. Jenna McLaughlin, NPR News.
You are listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Paramount Pictures, presenting the new film September 5. When gunshots are heard in the Olympic Village, broadcast history is made, based on a true story, in select theaters now, everywhere January 17th, rated R. And from Indeed, designed to be an end-to-end hiring solution for businesses of all sizes to attract, interview, and hire candidates all from one platform. Learn more at Indeed.com/NPR. This is NPR.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. David Lynch has died at the age of 78. He was the rare filmmaker whose name became an adjective. Lynchian stood for dark, surrealistic journeys into the subconscious. They were experiences unlike any other. Unsurprisingly, when Lynch decided to join Rachel Martin on NPR's Wild Card podcast, the experience was memorable.
I was experimenting with sound, and I came upon this thing. And at a point when Christabel came here, and she sang into this experiment, and she is perfect for this. And in ways I can't really explain. So it takes two or three times to hear it before it becomes beautiful.
So the first go out, you're like, oh, this is dissonant.
First hearing it, total Second hearing, a little bit less. Third hearing, beauty.
Huh.
It just clicked as being like a friend. And it conjures memories. That's how come the title came. In listening to this, all these way distant memories started bubbling up. Something about this music conjured memories.
We're gonna play the game.
Okay.
Round one, memories. One, two, three. Which one?
I'll take number one.
Number one. What was your form of rebelling as a teenager?
Okay, well, I lived three lives. I lived a home life. I lived a school life with my sweetheart, my girlfriend, and the studio art life. I had a studio during high school in downtown Alexandria with my friend Jack Fisk. So after school, I'd go to the studio. And then, you know, also was a bit of a party animal. So I had these three lives, and I didn't want any of them to mix, really. Hmm. So I developed spasms of the intestines.
You developed a condition? So you created it for yourself? It was psychosomatic?
I was a psychosomatic disease, yeah.
And what did it do for you?
I shit my pants. That's what happened. It was a horrible thing. However, I'll tell you a good side of this.
Okay.
The Vietnam War was cooking up around this time.
Right.
And my father took me to a doctor because this spasms in the intestines. And he said, by the way, I see on the x-rays you have a vertebrae out of place. And if you're ever called for the army, I can give you these x-rays and you probably won't be called if you want to get out. So spasms of intestines led to a doctor that helped me get out, and I didn't have to go to Vietnam.
Wow.
And let me live the art life, you know, in peace. You know, and that was so beautiful. I can't tell you how lucky I've been in my life, how fortunate and lucky I've been.
What were you rebelling against?
Part of life is, at a certain point, children are supposed to rebel. It's part of getting prepared to leave the nest. And it's a healthy thing. It's just some rebel more than others. And I caused a lot of sadness and worry for my parents. I know I did. I had a great relationship with them, but I put them through a lot of trouble.
Round two. These are insights.
Okay.
Things you're working on now or have learned now. One, two, or three?
I think I've worked my way to two now.
What failure have you learned the most from?
Dune, my film Dune. which I knew already one should have Final Cut before signing on to do a film. But for some reason, I thought everything would be okay, and I didn't put Final Cut in my contract. And as it turned out, Dune wasn't the film I wanted to make because I didn't have the final say. So that's a lesson I knew even before, but now there's no way. Why would anyone make a film, work for 3 years on something that wasn't yours? Why? Why do that? Why? I died the death, and it was all my fault for not knowing to do that. Put that in the contract.
So what did you learn from that?
Always have Final Cut. That's my lesson. Always. Creative control, Final Cut.
Last question. This is the beliefs round. 1, 2, 3.
3.
Where have you experienced awe?
Where have I experienced?
Awe.
Awe. Well, many times, but for sure, my first meditation, I'd just been taught, and I was taken to a little room, a little place, and my teacher said, sit here and start your meditation. I'll be back in 20 minutes. So I sat and closed my eyes, and boom. I say it was as if I was in an elevator, and someone snip the cables. Within I went. Whoa. Bliss. The bliss that make you cry. So beautiful. So powerful. Transcendental meditation is garbage going out, gold coming in. So there's a process of removing the obstacles to enlightenment and bringing in that which makes enlightenment. I always say we are living like in a suffocating rubber clown suit of negativity. We don't want to be clowns. We don't want to have this heavy stinking rubber all around us of negativity. You start transcending every day. The rubber starts disintegrating, evaporating, and freedom comes. Bliss starts coming. It's so beautiful. Why isn't everybody and his little brother meditating? I don't know. Go figure.
I mean, I have to say, you seem to truly have found some level of contentment that I don't think a lot of people have found.
It's all there within. If it, you know, it can happen to me, it can happen to anybody. And it's a great trip we're all on. It just makes it greater when you're transcending every day.
That was NPR's Rachel Martin speaking with filmmaker David Lynch, who has died at age 78. You can hear more of those conversations on the Wildcard Podcast.
This is NPR News.
Trump's inauguration will mark the end of a chapter for his political opponent, Kamala Harris. She'll no longer hold a seat in office, but she may continue to influence politics. What's to come for the vice president on the next morning edition from NPR News?
It's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Around the country, people are preparing for the mass deportations that Donald Trump has promised.
Including in Nebraska, where many farms hire immigrant workers who do not have legal status.
People say, well, just double or triple the pay, you'll get United States citizens to work. No, you won't.
First, the news.
Live from NPR News in Washington, I'm Windsor Johnston. Outgoing Secretary of State Antony Blinken says he's confident the ceasefire deal between Israel and Hamas will be carried out as planned.
Over 15 months of devastating conflict between Israel and Hamas, we've worked to broker a deal that would bring hostages home, that would stop the fighting, that would surge humanitarian aid to people who so desperately need it, that would create the space to conclude a permanent ceasefire. We now have that, and we expect implementation of the agreement to begin on Sunday.
The Israeli Security Cabinet is expected to begin voting on the agreement on Friday. Meanwhile, Israel continued to carry out airstrikes in the Gaza Strip today, killing more than 80 Palestinians. President-elect Donald Trump's pick to lead the Department of Housing and Urban Development told a Senate panel today that he would make the agency more efficient. NPR's Jennifer Ludden reports that Scott Turner rejected the idea of more federal investment to create affordable housing.
Turner said HUD already spends a lot, yet too many struggle with rent, and homelessness is at a record high.
HUD, if you will, is failing at its most basic mission, and that has to come to an end.
Turner said he'd review every HUD program to see which ones are succeeding, and said the housing voucher program needs to be less cumbersome for landlords. He also said he'd work with states to streamline regulations that slow down housing construction. Turner declined to say whether he'd push back if Trump proposed slashing HUD's budget, as he tried to do in his first term. Jennifer Ludden, NPR News, Washington.
Stocks traded lower today on Wall Street. The Dow was down 68 points. The Nasdaq Composite fell 172. This is NPR News. The commercial truck manufacturer Hino Trucks is pleading guilty to cheating on emissions tests. NPR's Camila Domonoski reports specifically the company submitted falsified data to regulators.
Vehicle manufacturers test their own products and send the results to state and federal agencies to prove they meet standards. California regulators found inconsistencies in Hino's data. It turns out for about a decade, Hino used fraudulent data to cover up trucks that polluted more than allowed. Between state and federal penalties, Hino is paying more than $1.6 billion. Some of that money will help fund programs for clean trucks. Toyota has also been caught sending fake data to Japanese regulators, a scandal its chairman publicly apologized for last year. Camila Domonoski, NPR News.
The government says it's reclaimed more than $30 million in federal payments that were sent out to people who have died. The Treasury Department was given temporary access by Congress to the Social Security Administration's full death master file. It contains more than 140 million records that dates back to 1899. The Treasury estimates that it will recover more than $215 million during its three-year access period that runs through next year. I'm Windsor Johnston, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the station. And from Hiscox, committed to helping small businesses protect their dreams, Quotes and information on customized insurance for specific risks are available at Hiscox.com. Hiscox, business insurance experts. And from Procter & Gamble, maker of Nervive, Nervive Nerve Relief is designed to reduce occasional nerve aches, weakness, and discomfort in hands or feet due to aging. Learn more at NerviveHealth.com. And from the Doris Duke Foundation.
This is All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Ari Shapiro.
And I'm Mary Louise Kelly. House Speaker Mike Johnson has fired the top Republican on the House Intelligence Committee. That would be Ohio Congressman Mike Turner. Turner has at times been a critic of President-elect Trump, a fierce defender of the intelligence community, and a defense hawk who supports ongoing aid to Ukraine. NPR political correspondent Susan Davis is in the studio. Hey, Sue.
Hey there.
What was the stated rationale behind the speaker's decision to oust Turner from a job he seemed to keep wanting to do?
Well, Turner says he clearly thinks it was personal. He told CBS that in his meeting with the speaker told him that there was, quote, concerns from Mar-a-Lago, directly alluding to the fact that Trump may have had direct involvement in this decision. The speaker denied that. He talked to reporters in the Capitol last night. He's heaped praise on Turner. He said he had done a great job as committee chair, that this was not a negative reflection on him, but that it was time, in his words, for fresh horses in certain key policy areas. Hmm. And look, as you all know, Mary Louise, Donald Trump is deeply skeptical of the intelligence establishment, and congressman like Mike Turner is seen as someone who's just more closely aligned with that establishment than the MAGA reform movement.
More closely aligned with that establishment, what do you mean?
I mean, he's more of part of the old guard of the Republican Party when it comes to foreign policy. He doesn't really share the MAGA movement's America First ideology. For example, he's been a defender of the NATO alliance. He's been a deep critic of Russia and President Vladimir Putin. He was also a central figure in the last Congress in renewing a controversial federal law that allows surveillance on foreign targets that has also been opposed by a lot of people on the right over fears of domestic overreach. The bottom line, I think, is he's just sort of out of lockstep with both the incoming president and his speaker on certain issues. And in that regard, it's not a huge shock that he would not be returning to this job.
Although, step back and just give us the context. How common is something like this in Congress for a committee chairman to essentially be punished?
In the Senate, it would be highly unusual, but frankly, in the House, it's pretty common. Committee chairmanships are pretty political jobs. And in this committee in particular, the Intelligence Committee is what's known as a select committee. And what that means is that the people that serve on it serve at the pleasure of party leaders. The speaker uniquely decides who's on it. So they are almost an extension of party leadership and the people in power. And Turner doesn't exactly fit that mold. The intelligence chairman, he was also appointed by former Speaker Kevin McCarthy. He was sort of seen as a McCarthy guy. So it's also not that unusual that Speaker Johnson would want to put one of his own people in place.
Okay, so Speaker Johnson well within his rights here.
Yeah.
What about President Trump's alleged role? I mean, Congress, obviously, as the legislative branch, they're supposed to serve as a check on the executive branch. Is it not unusual for a president to concern himself with committee assignments in Congress?
It's very unusual. I can't think of an example of a past president doing so, but Trump operates like no other. Trump has also made clear that he wants people more loyal to his worldview, especially in these national security roles. So look at this decision in the broader context here. Donald Trump has tapped former Democratic Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard to be his director of national intelligence. She still has to be confirmed by the Senate. He's also asked former Congressman and intelligence chairman Devin Nunes, also a deep critic of the intelligence community, to chair a new advisory board in his administration. These are people who are critics of the intelligence world and that foreign surveillance law and its potential abuses. They're seen as reformers. Obviously, this is going to open Republicans up to criticism that something nefarious is afoot here. Jim Himes, he's the top Democrat on the committee, said it was a terrible sign of what's to come. But I think this is generally a reflection of the bigger shift that is coming in this arena as Trump prepares to take office.
Just briefly, Sue, what do we need to know about Rick Crawford? That is the Arkansas congressman who apparently is going to be the new chair of the Intelligence Committee.
Well, he comes from a much more conservative district than Turner. He's been on the committee for about a decade, so he's prepared for the job. Like Turner, I'd note he did also support that federal surveillance law last year, but unlike Turner, he's been a critic of Ukraine aid. He voted against it, and he's also seen as someone who's more closely aligned to Speaker Mike Johnson.
NPR Susan Davis, thanks, Sue.
You're welcome.
Shakespeare has been performed in a lot of obscure places, but the film Grand Theft Hamlet finds a new one. Critic Bob Mondello says the action is full of sound and fury, largely because it takes place entirely inside the video game Grand Theft Auto.
To be or not to be an actor? That was a serious question back during pandemic lockdowns. Live theaters were closed. Gathering indoors, even with masks, was a non-starter for a lot of people. In 2021, out-of-work actor pals Sam Crane and Mark Oosterveen were communicating mostly through their video game avatars.
Just run up these hills.
In GTA Grand Theft Auto.
If you go somewhere kind of rural, they won't drive up here, will they?
They'd been tooling around the GTA landscapes in stolen golf carts, the police on their tails.
Look at this.
Look at what?
They hopped a wall and found themselves in what looks like the Hollywood Bowl.
It's like a massive kind of arena.
A huge amphitheater with a stage.
Oh God,
and,
so cool.
Well, they're actors.
I wonder if you could actually stage something here.
What, like a put on a play?
Yeah.
It would be difficult, because generally, you know, people are violent in the game. They blow stuff up and they shoot
people. Yeah, but people are violent in Shakespeare. It's brutal. It's like in Hamlet, everyone dies. It's perfect, come on.
No sooner have they decided to take a stab at it than a couple of audience members show up.
Oh, someone's here, look. Hi.
Shooting.
If I could just request that you refrain from killing each other and don't kill the actors either. Yeah, start, Mark.
If you do meet
As is the custom in GTA, everyone has guns.
Bid them make haste.
I think I hear them.
Rocket launchers, too.
Stan Ho, who's there?
Friends to this ground, I think.
I don't think so.
And leechmen to the Dane.
And they're both dead.
All right, we did pretty well to get as far as we did.
Helicopter, not an helicopter.
So, okay, good start. Could they make more of it? Sam's wife, Penny Grills, is a documentary filmmaker. She starts recording everything they do inside Grand Theft Auto online. This film is technically a documentary. And she helps them make a promotional video within the game to get other gamers involved.
We are putting on a production of Hamlet in GTA Online for the first time ever.
The video shoot becomes a battleground.
So come and audition. Please try to stop us. Can't stop our...
But that makes it seem pretty cool.
They got me.
And some randos do show up to audition.
Oh my God, they're really coming down now, look. Whoa.
Hi.
That's quite an entrance.
You can call me Star.
I'm Jen.
I'm Tilly.
Including a naked green alien who doesn't know any Shakespeare but recites a bit of the Quran. It quickly becomes clear that performing in the amphitheater doesn't make sense when all this digital world's a stage, so they start hatching plans to do Act 2 in a subway, Act 4 atop a high-flying blimp.
You can stand on top of the actual balloon and act out a scene while it's moving.
If they can stop falling off to their death.
It's like Shakespeare on $1 billion budget.
Also intriguing is the mid-pandemic camaraderie that develops.
Keep coming across these people who want to help us.
Reassuring out-of-work principals who have understandable bouts of melancholy, ones that track so well with the lines they speak as the melancholy Dane that it doesn't always sound like they're just acting. It all adds up to a unique Hamlet, and I say that as a theater critic who's caught 37 before this, not one of them with flamethrowers, rocket launchers, or flying DeLoreans. The film Grand Theft Hamlet is constantly surprising, breathtakingly imaginative, and a great introduction to Shakespeare, or I guess to video games, whichever you need introducing to. I'm Bob Mandela.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News. During big elections, states like California take weeks to count all their ballots. Now, lawmakers in some of those states are looking at ways to speed things up. A key question is whether legislators can do that without sacrificing access to the ballot. NPR's Ashley Lopez reports.
This past election cycle in Arizona was far less chaotic than in 2020 when false information fueled protest. But it's not like there weren't any complaints in this last election.
You know, I have never received as many calls or messages from constituents as I have regarding getting election results faster.
That's Warren Peterson. He's a Republican state senator in Arizona. He says the state takes way too long to count ballots. That can slow down how quickly media outlets like the Associated Press call races. And Peterson says it doesn't have to be this way.
I mean, we live in this modern era where you can order something on Amazon and get it immediately the same day.
Peterson is one of several lawmakers across the country who are trying to figure out how to speed up election results in their state. So far, lawmakers in California, Nevada, Utah, and Wisconsin are working on legislation as well. Sam Oliker-Friedland with the Institute for Responsive Government says he understands why this is something voters are asking for. But he says there are a lot of reasons why it may take some states longer to count votes, and they aren't necessarily problems.
The biggest structural difference that affects how fast election results are going to come is the proportion of ballots that are cast by mail versus in person at a polling place.
He says basically the more mail-in ballots a state has to count, the longer it is likely to take. That's because there are way more steps in counting those ballots. And one way to deal with that is to allow election workers to pre-process them sooner. That's taking mail ballots out of the envelope, checking the ID information, and verifying voter signatures. Pamela Smith with Verified Voting, a group focused on technology in elections, says election workers can use that time before Election Day to get most of this done.
And if you find someone didn't sign it, sign the envelope, then you can work on that, getting that cured, those kinds of things. You can take care of all of those things over a period of time.
Another way that lawmakers are looking to speed things up is by shortening the window that voters can return mail-in ballots. That's something Warren Peterson in Arizona is proposing. Peterson said this could affect hundreds of thousands of voters who currently drop off ballots right before or on Election Day. But it will save a lot of time, and his bill will create some more in-person early voting days. In California, Democratic Assemblymember Mark Berman is unsure of exactly how he wants to speed up election results, but he's not comfortable limiting access to mail-in voting.
I personally will never consider a proposal that's going to water down the voting rights of Californians in exchange for things happening faster. That's not a trade-off that I'm willing to make. It's not a trade-off I think we need to make.
Pamela Smith with Verified Voting says even though voters want fast results, they are not an important benchmark of whether elections are running well. She said it would be useful for lawmakers and advocates to instead educate the public on why counting ballots takes time.
I think that there needs to be a shift in the mindset about, you know, continue to say that we won't know the election results on election night and that's okay. And here's why.
Smith says as long as election results are finalized in time for elected officials to be sworn in, it doesn't really matter how fast it happens. Ashley Lopez, NPR News.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
From NPR News, this is All Things Considered. I'm Mary Louise Kelly.
And I'm Ari Shapiro. Nebraska is one of the top meat producers in the U.S. It also has one of the worst labor shortages in the country. For every 100 jobs, there are only 39 workers. A report released last January by the state's economic chamber says Nebraska has no choice but to welcome immigrants to, quote, address the workforce gap. But that message runs counter to President-elect Trump's pledge to carry out mass deportations. NPR's Jasmine Garst reports.
Every so often, Al Junkie, executive director of the Nebraska Pork Producers Association, says that he'll get a phone call from a farmer. It goes something like this.
Al, I got a great idea.
On how to solve Nebraska's severe labor shortage.
Why don't we invite any immigrant, legal, illegal, I don't care, invite them to Nebraska, because we have lots of openings out on our farm and we need help.
Junkie smiles warily. He and several dozen other Nebraska advocacy and business groups have formed an alliance to demand a reform of federal immigration laws and state policy. They want an expansion of worker visa programs and a pathway to residency for immigrants already here.
And these are good paying jobs in the plants.
Junkie says attracting labor is not about wages. The average pay for a meat trimmer is close to $18 an hour, well above the state minimum of $13.50.
People say, well, just double or triple the pay, you'll get United States citizens to work. No, you won't.
Nebraska needs immigrants, but Nebraskans overwhelmingly voted for incoming President Donald Trump, who has promised to carry out mass deportations. When asked about it, Junkie echoes what a lot of people here say.
I think those same voters at this point in time will tell you it's just not going to happen.
Tell that to the families that got separated and still haven't found their children.
Elsa R. Aranda is the state director of LULAC, the oldest Hispanic civil rights organization in the U.S. She says she wants to talk about protecting immigrant lives, not just labor.
Let's harness immigrant labor. Let's harness like an animal. It's dehumanizing.
At the end of the day, she says Nebraskans have no other choice.
Yes, yes, we know people hate immigrants that are not here legally, deport them all, et cetera, et cetera. Well, what are you going to do when you don't have workers?
The governor of Nebraska, Jim Pillen, recently assembled a task force to help address the labor shortage. NPR reached out to his office for comment and did not receive a response. Pillen has also pledged his support for incoming President Trump, deporting unauthorized immigrants who pose a threat. But Trump has repeatedly said he plans a much larger scale deportation. And in the meatpacking towns, the rumor mill is working overtime. You can see the city of Fremont on the horizon, the billowing smoke towers from the massive meat plants. If you buy chicken at Costco, it likely comes from here. If you eat Spam, it possibly got processed here. And on a Friday evening, its streets and bars are eerily empty. We eventually meet one man who is willing to talk if we withhold his last name. He's scared of retaliation. Richie is from El Salvador. He says he's here legally.
Como tienen papeles chuecos, los han quitado, pero esas plazas quedan vacías porque no las llenan con nuevo empleado.
After the election, his plant let go of many undocumented workers, but now there's not enough people to fill the jobs. So he's been picking up double shifts. He's grateful for the work, but his coworkers, they joke constantly about being deported. They assume their fate is sealed.
Ellos ya sienten que lo van a deportar. Casi todos lo hacen en broma ya. Se escuchan resignados totalmente.
In Central America, there's an expression, tragar grueso, a hard swallow. That's what he says he does when they joke. He's applying for asylum for political persecution in El Salvador and says his life could be at risk if he got sent back. So Richie, he goes to work with his papers tucked into his uniform. NPR reached out to several meat processing plants to inquire about how they're dealing with the possibility of raids. We received no response. Off mic, Richie asks me, is it true that the U.S. government is going to start offering $1,000 for each undocumented immigrant person reported to the authorities? He plays me the TikTok where he saw it.
$1,000 a las personas.
This is false, but Richie and his co-workers have watched it several times. On the other end of the state, in the city of North Platte, the situation might come to a head soon. The population in North Platte has been declining for the last decade or so. Unlike so many other Nebraska towns, there are no meat processing factories here, for now. This summer, a plant called Sustainable Beef is slated to open. The company declined an interview with NPR, but the North Platte Area Chamber and Development Corporation confirmed that over 800 jobs will be created, an estimated $1.2 billion added to the local economy every year. A large sign just off the highway reads, "The whole world is understaffed. Be kind to those who showed up."
We understand the economic necessity of it, and we're not stupid.
Janet Evans goes to the Episcopal Church of Our Savior in North Platte. Before we talk, the parishioners express their apprehension. Is this going to be yet another story about a town that voted against its own interests for mass deportations when what they need is immigrant labor?
As a rule, we are practical and we are nice and we like our neighbors.
She's part of a program that will pair newly arrived migrant families who come to work at the plant with host families. As she gives us a tour of the church, a black and white photo stands out of a Japanese man sitting in a jail cell. Father Hiram Kano, part of a wave of Japanese migrants who came to North Platte in the 1920s to work in the beet fields. He was eventually taken to an internment camp. In the Episcopalian faith, he's known as the Nebraska Saint. Evans sighs. She says she's bracing for what the next 4 years will look like for immigrants.
I do not know what that looks like. It is terrifying to me, too.
But she also believes the future looks bright for North Platte. Soon, the new plant will open. More people will come to Platte.
We will have lots of little boutiques. We'll have a diverse, lovely school system. We will have a growing number of people who are bilingual. And that is what I dream of.
Her door is open. But is America's? Jasmine Garst, NPR News, Nebraska.
You're listening to All Things Considered from NPR News.
Support for NPR comes from the station and from Sony Pictures Classics with The Room Next Door, starring Julianne Moore and Tilda Swinton. Years later, two friends meet again in an extreme situation. Directed by Pedro Almodovar, now playing select cities, opens everywhere Friday. From Fisher Investments, Fisher is committed to helping clients stay on track to reach their financial goals and enjoy a comfortable retirement. FisherInvestments.com. Investing in securities involves the risk of loss. And from Dignity Memorial, helping families protect their loved ones and gain peace of mind by planning cremations and funerals in advance. Dedicated to professionalism and compassion.
As I can be. Any depot or stockyard is home sweet home to me. I have no cares like millionaires, no grief to make me blue. I go my